Well, good morning again. It's good to be with you. For those who are visiting, I am not Eddie Sharp. And that may be either really good news or really bad news, depending on whether or not you know Eddie Sharp. But now he is a wonderful man. We miss he and Annette when they're away. And they're away for the next 2 weekends. So you're stuck with me. Lucky you. So you may want to start making your plans now for where you'd like to visit next week, but I hope you'll be here with us. But as we get started, I just want to reiterate one thing that Dia mentioned, and the Alzheimer's Walk that Miss Gail here is helping out with is really a wonderful opportunity to love and bless some really folks in need. And so I just want to encourage you to consider partnering with her in doing that, and she's accepting money starting today. Right? So as soon as you're ready to give, she's ready to accept it, and it'll be a wonderful blessing. So great opportunity. If you have more questions about that, come talk to us. We'll be glad to get you the right information. But it'd be a great chance to show love and support. Have you ever tried to change something that you didn't really want to change? Has anybody ever been there before? We start those New Year's resolutions, right? And they always start, it's such a great idea, it's such a great thing, and yet somehow it just never quite sticks around. Well, this morning, we're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to try to change something when your heart's not really in it. Or maybe you really don't want to, and perhaps you don't even know that you don't want to just yet. But we're here right in the middle of John 7. And Eddie's been walking us through the gospel, and so far we're beginning to sense this increase in pressure. There's so many themes that run through John's gospel. We see things about timing. There's a lot of emphasis on it was the right time or it wasn't the right time. And we see Jesus was very keenly aware of his time. And so we read that a lot. There's a lot to say about knowledge and who really knows and who really doesn't know. And the folks that think they know don't really know. And the folks that don't really think they know actually kind of know. We see these wonderful themes kind of just woven all the way through the Gospel of John. Well, this morning we kind of arrive here in chapter 7. And as you remember from last week, Jesus has been teaching in Capernaum. And he's kind of traveling around, and he's had some pretty hard things to say. And Eddie kind of shared those with us last week. And as he began his, I begin mine. This, I hope this is not like preaching by fire hose, where you just dump so much information on people, there's no possible way to take it in. And so we're just going to focus on a couple of pieces of the story and trust that you'll go back and have a chance to reread it and think some and reflect on it. I know in our Sunday school class, our soul training exercise this week was to read through the Gospel of John. And so hopefully it's been somewhat on your mind and in your hearts. But as we do, we kind of pick up with Jesus saying, I am the bread of life. If you really want to eat and to be satisfied, to be filled, to never be hungry again, come to me and eat. And he gives this teaching, unless someone eats my flesh and drinks my blood, unless they do that, they really won't have a part of me. They won't be in eternity with me. And it's a really tough teaching. In fact, John tells us that it was so tough that many turned away and many left. And so we see kind of at the end of the chapter, Jesus turns to his own followers and says, well, you guys want to take off too? And Peter, in these beautiful words, says, where would we go, Lord? To whom would we go? Nobody feeds us the way you feed us. Who else has words of life? And so we have this kind of beautiful ending. And so we pick up kind of in chapter 7. And I don't know about you, maybe this just says more about me, but I kind of like to imagine where Jesus and his brothers were here at the beginning of chapter 7. I wonder if it's like Saturday afternoon at the house where the football game comes on or what's kind of going on. But they're talking about this Feast of Tabernacles is coming up. And the Feast of Tabernacles was one of three major feasts that happened in the lives of the Jews back in Jerusalem. There were three times of the year that they would pilgrimage back to Jerusalem and have a huge, huge feast. It's very similar to our Thanksgiving, but there, Feast of the Tabernacles actually lasted all week. And it was 8 days. Started on a Sabbath and ran to a Sabbath. And the first and last days were kind of these days of silence and worship. And then the 6 days in between were a huge celebration. And each day they would have different processions that would happen. They would have these huge four huge lampstands that they would bring in, and they would set up and they would light these lamps, and it was so much light that it would light up the whole city. Other times they would have processions where they would march down to the Pool of Siloam and get water and bring it back. And while the priests were carrying fruit and waving palm branches, and it was kind of a big harvest celebration, celebrating what God had done. But the people would also build little huts in the temple courts and all through the streets. And those were the tabernacles. That's why you have Feast of Tabernacles. It was also a reminder of how God took care of His people when they were wandering in the desert, living in these makeshift kind of huts, and God eating what God provides. And so we saw some of that imagery in the last chapter when Jesus says, I am the bread of life. As opposed to that manna that you eat that still leaves you hungry. If you come to me and feast, you'll never go hungry. We see the same imagery now happening again. But this picture is of the brothers sitting around talking about their plans for the feast. And they look at Jesus and say, hey bro, why don't you go? You're doing some things around here. I mean, nobody who wants to be really famous and really get a following just kind of hangs out in this area. Why don't you go to Jerusalem? Show what you got up there. Show yourself to the world, they say. And it's interesting, in Jesus' response, we can see how different their ideas are, and that they really don't have a clue of what's really going on in Jesus' life. I mean, He has a very keen sense of time, and we'll see this even in this chapter, that Jesus does things very strategically. In fact, timing is really crucial. But Jesus says, this festival, this isn't my time. This isn't my time. Listen to His words. The right time hasn't come. For you, any time is right. The world can't hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. You go to the feast. I am not yet going up to this feast because for me, the right time has not yet come. Like, guys, I'm not going to go. I think Jesus knew that if He were to gather all the folks that were already following Him and they were to try to make their way up to Jerusalem as they were, as He's healing and teaching and more folks are coming, their idea about who the Messiah is and what He's going to do, that somehow by the time they reach Jerusalem, it's going to be at fever pitch and they're going to be ready to declare Jesus Messiah and King and ready for you to move in power. And Jesus knew this isn't the right time for that. He was working on a different timing. He knew that His purpose and His plan didn't have a tabernacle kind of motivation. It had a Passover motivation. And so Jesus says, I'm not going to go. You guys go on. But we quickly learn that He doesn't stay away from the festival the whole time. Instead, he decides to go kind of incognito, to just kind of see perhaps and hear what's going on, what's being said about Him. And we'll see pretty early on in the chapter that those same concerns that have been following Him for the last few chapters, especially since chapter 5 and the healing on the Sabbath, that those same questions and concerns are still happening amongst the crowd. The first one was, is Jesus a good guy or is He deceiving people? There was a lot of pushback on this, and this was a really important question because in Deuteronomy 13 there was a lot to say about false prophets coming. And be careful of those who would teach, and it even says who would perform signs. And if those signs actually happen, if those wonders that they are claiming actually occur, they're going to say, we should follow other gods. And so Deuteronomy is really clear about what you do with those kind of false prophets, those deceivers. It says you stone them, you kill them. So this wasn't just a simple, do you like him? I kind of like him. Do you like, you know? This was, who is this guy? Is he good or is he trying to really deceive people? Well, there's also a question about the source of his teaching. We even read here that when he comes a few days into the festival and he begins to teach, that the people are surprised. They say, here we go. Verse 15. The Jews were amazed and asked, how did this man get such learning without having studied? So some of you may have seen the Numa video, Dust, where Rob Bell talks a lot about the process of becoming a rabbi and what it takes, that you start from the time that you are a child and you begin by memorizing the Torah. And then the kids who can do that and kind of make the next step, well, then they move on and they memorize the entire Old Testament. And then those kids, the best of the best are picked from them, and then they move on and they begin to follow rabbi. And then they spend years and years and years following this rabbi and learning the scriptures and learning to interpret and practicing all of these things. And it takes years, if not decades, for this process to occur. Well, they look at him and they know, Jesus hasn't done any of this. Where did he learn to teach like this? Where does he get this information? Because it's very clear, Jesus' understanding and knowledge of the scriptures was very thorough. And he had the power to teach in such a way that it captivated people. It had a way of opening up things that people hadn't understood before. It was an amazing thing. In fact, the best teachers of the day were looking at it and going, how does he do this? Nobody ever taught him to do this. So we see these questions about, is he good, is he not? Where does he come from? What is he teaching? These questions are swirling around. And so Jesus arrives and he begins to answer and address some of these questions. So we pick up in verse 16, he says, my teaching is not my own. It comes from the one who sent me. Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. Jesus says very boldly, I'm not making this stuff up. These aren't my words. I am teaching you what was given to me. It's not my own. It's from the will of God. Now, it's interesting here. Jesus does this little shift, and I don't know if you saw it. I know I missed it my first few thousand times through this passage. But notice Jesus says, anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. Jesus says, if you're hungry for the will of God, if your desire is to do God's will, then you can listen to what I say and it'll make real clear sense where my teaching comes from. See, the Pharisees were coming at it from the other side. They were saying, no, we know what God says. He told us, we interpreted it, we got some laws around here to help us keep that. Now, let's figure you out. Let's compare what you're saying now to what we already know. And Jesus says, actually, that's not how it works. That's not how it works. You got to know God first. And from there, you'll begin to see what my teaching, how it fits, how it connects. Jesus doesn't stop there, though. He continues in verse 18. He says, whoever speaks on their own does so to gain personal glory. But he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There is nothing false about him. So Jesus quickly addresses these two questions in just a couple of verses, saying, I'm not here preaching my own message. These aren't my own words that I'm offering up, but rather they're the words that God has given me. And I'm not seeking my own glory. I'm seeking the glory of the Father. This is a powerful lesson, a powerful witness to those in Jerusalem. Because we hear, again, at the very beginning, his brothers say, go show yourself to the world. And Jesus says, the world's not quite ready for me yet. And John wants us to hear the world is not just everybody on the face of the earth. But this idea of the world being those in Jerusalem, and especially those who at one time had known God, had become his people, and yet had strayed away from him. And now had kind of taken on the world's mindset of, I know for myself what I need. I don't need you to tell me what to do. And so in a sense, the folks in Jerusalem whom he's going to see, who he will present himself to, it's not just everybody, but this idea of even God's people who at one time knew him, but because of now what they think they know, they've slowly moved away from him. And now it's become about the law, it's become about the rules, it's become about that outward expression. And we've missed the heart, we've missed the purpose of where it all began in the first place. My mind went to 1 Peter this week as I was thinking about this sermon and who was there and who was listening. And then these words from Peter's letter to the church in Asia Minor came to mind. Remember these words? live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God in heaven. Peter says, live in such a way that even though the people look at you and they accuse you and they malign your motives, that they'll see the good deeds in your life and they'll glorify who? God. That your work and even your suffering would bring glory to God. He continues in chapter 4. He says, each one of you should use whatever gift he has received to serve others, faithfully administering God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength that God provides, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. And whatever you do, Peter says, however you live, whether you're serving or giving or praying, whatever you do, do it that it might bring glory to God. It's not about you, it's about God. So I thought Peter must have been hanging around this day. And these words really sunk into his life. Now for him, it may have been one of those plantings, because we know it took a while for that to germinate in his life, right? And we saw his struggles over time, but we know eventually it sprouted and it took root. And here we see years and years and years later, Peter cultivating this church saying, let me tell you about the real purpose and meaning of what you do. I heard it one day. Let me tell you a story. Well, the same call goes out to us today. You see, many Christians in their hearts and minds have decided, well, I already know what God says. I've got all the answers inside. I don't need anybody else to tell me anything. We've got it all figured out. And so we've kind of closed our minds off that maybe God has a new word, that maybe God has a call to us, maybe He has a challenge to us in our life, that we've taken maybe a belief and we've set it up and it's now become a pillar, it's become an altar. And He's saying, you got to break that down. It's time to move through. You see, Jesus kind of takes the same challenge as He continues on in this sermon to the Jewish leaders and the people around. He brings up circumcision. And He uses that as an example to them of how they have taken something that began with a purpose and intent, and yet somehow now are using it to actually break another law. He refers them back to the miracle that He performed in chapter 5 when He heals the man on the Sabbath and He says, get up, take your mat, and go. You're healed. And He draws them back to that story. And He says, as He talks to them about it, He says, Moses gave you this law that on the eighth day after a child is born, he must be circumcised. Even if that eighth day is on the Sabbath, it must happen in order to make this part of his body, his body, whole with the covenant of God. So it takes something that, at least on the outside, at first, initially, looks like it's breaking the law. We can't do that on the Sabbath. The Lord told us to rest on the Sabbath. And the law said, well, no, that actually doing that act, even on the Sabbath, brings healing and restoration to this body. And so Jesus says, how much more so if we could heal the whole body on the Sabbath? Doesn't that make sense? I mean, if we could bless and restore someone on the Sabbath, doesn't that work for you? See, the Pharisees are so blinded by their closed mind that they can't even see that. They can't even respond to that. Well, Jesus continues on, and sadly this problem still exists for us today. We have these ideas and these thoughts about who Jesus is based on these faulty ideas about who we think God is. And these are both people inside and outside the church. We've kind of picked up this belief somewhere in our Sunday school class. We've been reading this book, The Good and Beautiful God. And one of the things it's challenged us to do is to step back and begin to think about God through the eyes of Christ. And who does Jesus say that God is? Because it's crucial. If not, if we kind of slide that to the side, then we can take our own personal idea or thought or narrative from ourselves or from the culture, and we begin to hold that up as who God is. And it blinds us from the truth. Well, the religious leaders do not like this accusation that they are using one law to break another. They don't like it. And so we again see they try to seize him, but it's not his time. It's not his time. Well, down in verse 37, we see Jesus and this conversation continues to go on. And so here at the last day of the feast, as Andrew read just a few minutes ago, on the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him." And by this he meant the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were later to receive. We hear this similar call echoing back to chapter 6 when he says, "If anyone is hungry, come eat. If anyone is thirsty, come to me and drink." And from within, in the old King James version says, out of his belly will flow rivers of living water. Paul, if you read in the Greek, Paul talks about loving people from his guts. You see, in Jesus' day, the seat of emotion, that place where emotion and feeling and kind of will, desire existed was in the belly. And so we see Jesus literally says, out of your belly will flow. And today we think of that as our heart. But it's that place that gets all tied up in knots in us when we're facing uncertainty or anxiety, or when there's trouble in our life, or relational trouble, or work trouble, or school trouble. It's that place that feels empty or hollow when we're dissatisfied, when we're feeling alone. Jesus says, "Is anyone thirsty? Is anybody thirsty? Is anybody hungry? Then come to me and drink." You know, on the last day of this festival, I wonder if this sermon was done. Remember, I told you one of the processions around the temple was they would carry this water and this wine, and they would pour it. The priest would march it into the temple, and they would pour it over the altar. And it was a reminder of God's provision and His grace and His love pouring over. And I just wonder if that's kind of going on in the background. And Jesus is saying, if you're really thirsty, if you're really thirsty, won't you come to me and drink? See, this invitation to those people back then is the same invitation that we have before us today. The amazing thing is we see and experience life following Jesus, that there's an invitation to come to Him and drink. And it will require some things of you. That is certainly true. But what's very clear is Jesus always begins with, it's an invitation if you're thirsty. If there's anything that we could do this morning to help you on your journey, to continue to invite you each week to come thirsty and to step back into the flow of God's Spirit, won't you come forward this morning as we stand and as we sing?